Okay, I got 9 o'clock.
Tell me when you're ready.
There you go, I've got that.
And it is recording, so we're good.
We'll call the Administrative Rules Committee to order. Let's clerk take the roll.
Chairman Devlin?
Here.
Representative Banning?
Here.
Boshi?
Here.
Koppelman?
Here.
Lauzer?
Here.
Pyle?
Here.
Schneider? Seibel?
Here.
Toman?
Here.
Weiss? Senators Pullman?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Armstrong?
Yep.
Heckman?
Here.
Kilzer?
Here.
Klein?
Here.
Meyer?
Here.
And Rust?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you. Consideration of the minutes from our June 14th meeting. What's your wishes? They've been moved in second for approval. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion approved. We have a presentation from by Vanette on just some of the supplementary rules, because this is essentially the first meeting of the Administrative Rules Committee in this interim. So the June one was the end of the last one for this committee, because we're a statutory committee. So Vanette, if you would be so kind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The supplementary rules, I don't believe there's anything different from the previous interims, but I will go hit a few of the highlights. The call of the meetings is the time and place is set by the chairman. Any committee meetings outside the state require legislative management approval, and I believe also committees that are meetings that are held outside of Bismarck. The rules and customs of the Legislative Assembly govern the interim committees as well. Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure governs our rules and customs. Attendance by a member of the committee by interactive video is limited and is subject to the approval of the Legislative Management Chairman. If there is attendance by interactive video or a teleconference, all members of the committee must have the same opportunity to participate if one does. No secret ballots may be used in voting, and every member who is present must vote on every recorded roll call. The meetings are all electronically recorded. Let's see, some other highlights. On top of the second column, no substantial expansion of the committee work beyond the study resolution or directives without Legislative Management Chairman approval. No bill draft other than one drafted by Legislative Council staff may be approved unless it's been considered at least two meeting days. Subsection 4, some of the duties of the Legislative Management Chairman are listed there. Some that usually come up in interim committees is that there can't be any expansion of duties unless the Legislative Management approves them, and Legislative Management Chairman can assign additional duties. And no subcommittee may be formed from an interim committee without Legislative Management Chairman approval. Number 5 on the next page, at the end of this cycle, next after the September 2018 meeting, there will be a report prepared for Legislative Management, which will be presented to the Legislative Management in the November meeting preceding the 2019 session. Staffing, as you know, is done by Legislative Council staff. We are supervised by Jim Smith, who's the Director of Legislative Council, who then reports to the Legislative Management Chairman. The Legislative Council staff prepares the information that is presented to you at the committees, as well as bill drafts. And that kind of summarizes that, Mr. Chairman. Any questions?
Questions from the committee? See none. Do you want to do the
I will.
Background?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Administrative Rules Committee, I have prepared a background memo going through some of the procedures. It's a quite lengthy memo. I will try to just hit the highlights. It's a complicated area. There's a lot of nuances to administrative rules, and I hope some of this, especially for the members who haven't been on this committee before, will be helpful. I took over this committee from John Walstead at the end of 2014. So it's been about 3 years since I've been doing this. I continue to learn. There's always new things that I didn't realize were part of the process, and so it is definitely a learning experience. In North Dakota Century Code, Chapter Section 5435.02.5 requires the legislative management during each interim to appoint a committee in the same manner that interim committees are appointed. The membership of this committee includes members who have from at least one from each committee who have served in the last regular session from the standing committees of either the House or the Senate. So, for example, you have a member from the Human Services Committee, it can be a member from either the House or the Senate. It doesn't require from both. The Administrative Rules Committee's duties are to review administrative rules adopted under Chapter 2832. 2832 is known as the Administrative Agency Practices Act, and it is the procedure and guidelines that guide the agencies and boards and commissions in adopting rules and going through their hearing procedures and appeals procedures. This committee is responsible for studying and reviewing administrative rules and statutes to determine that administrative agencies are properly implementing legislative purpose and intent, to determine whether there's dissatisfaction with administrative rules or statutes relating to administrative rules, and whether there are unclear or ambiguous statutes relating to administrative rules. As I mentioned, Section 2832, Chapter 2832, is the Administrative Agency Practices Act. That the administrative code itself, which is published by the Legislative Council, consists of 129 titles. 96 of those are administrative agencies. 16 agencies publish their rules voluntarily, so that they are all combined in one place, but they are not considered administrative agencies. The remaining titles of those 129 are titles that are reserved, are defunct, or repealed, or have been declared unconstitutional. The administrative code in the published form is distributed free to county auditors, Supreme Court justices, district court judges, and certain state agencies. There are 56 of these free subscriptions. At one time, there was a paper copy, a binder with supplements provided through a subscription service. However, since going to a CD-ROM format, the cost has dropped from $460 a year, $460 for a starter set and $260 a year for supplements, to just $60 a year. Those are distributed by the Secretary of State's office. The numbering system for the administrative code is similar to the North Dakota Century Code. As you know, the Century Code is divided into three sets of numbers separated by a hyphen. The first number is the title, the second number is the chapter, the third number is the section. In the administrative code, there are four sets of numbers. For example, the number, I'll refer to one in the Department of Human Services, 75-02-04-01. The first number indicates the agency. The second number is called the article, which is the major activity or the division within that agency. The third number designates the subject matter, and the fourth is the rule, is actually the section. So, for example, 7502-0401, 75 is Human Services, 02 is Economic Assistance, 04 is Child Support, and then 01 is the rule, which is definitions. Since 1977, agencies have been adopting rules, but however, there was no formal compilation or central compilation at that time. In 1977, Chapter 2032, which requires the North Dakota Legislative Council to compile and publish the administrative code, went into effect. From that date until 2005, the administrative code supplements were published on the month after the rules were considered by the committee. Since September 2005, the supplements have been published on a quarterly basis. The current deadlines, which are in statute, are listed in that box at the bottom of the first page. As you can see, for example, the meeting we're having today is the deadline to hold this meeting was September 15th, so we're within the deadline. The rules, the filing of those rules occurred between May 2nd and August 1st. So August 1st was the deadline for agencies to get the rules to our office, our Legislative Council office, for the September meeting. And then those rules that are considered today will go into effect October 1st. So it's always the first of the month following the meeting is the effective date. On the next page is just a kind of a little summary of what this committee has been doing, you know, since 1979, as far as the number of sections that are considered in an interim. As you can see, that number varies considerably, and this is strictly the number of sections. You know, some sections may be shorter, others, you know, some may be longer, or less complex, or you know, or vice versa. As you can see, last interim we had we went from 1383 to 2,108 sections that were considered. You know, almost a 50% increase. Which was probably due to one meeting where we had 1,500 pages from the health department. So for the first time, we went to three volumes of our supplement. And then the next box is the number of supplement pages. The actual, you know, this supplement has 25 pages. As you can see, again, that went up about 800 pages from the 13-14 interim to the 15-16 interim. The information at that bottom of the page is a little bit repetitive from what was earlier about the makeup of this committee. The top of the next committee, or top of the next page, excuse me, is objections to rules. In 1981, this committee was authorized to make formal objections to rules. If the committee objects to rules, there is a formal process of filing an objection in a certified form with the Legislative Council, and this sets up, shifts the burden of persuasion to the agency to establish why the rule should not be voided. If an agency fails to establish their burden of persuasion, the court is to declare the rule invalid and award cost to the agency, or to assess cost to the agency. In 1995, this committee's authority was expanded to allow the committee to void rules. It allows the committee to avoid any or all of a portion of a rule if certain specific findings are made. Those include absence of statutory authority, there's an emergency relating to public health, safety, or welfare. There was a failure to express, to comply with express legislative intent. There's a conflict with state law. The rule is arbitrary or capricious, or there was a failure to make a proper written record of all the oral and written submissions during the hearing and comment period. If this committee finds a rule void, there is an appeal process for that agency, which includes a review by legislative management. To find a rule void, and this is where our committee date comes in, it has to be on the agenda no later than the 15th of the month before the date in which the rule change was to appear. There is a procedure for requiring someone from the agency to attend the meeting. If no one is in attendance to discuss the rule. It is carried over for one meeting. If no one attends at that next meeting, then the rules are considered void. Section 18 of Chapter 2832 allows a rule to allows the committee in agreement with the agency to make amendments to rules without going through the formal rulemaking process. For example, if there was a rule where there was an error or something there was some disagreement between the committee and the agency, if we can work out an agreement on what that should be, the committee can vote on that, and that rule change will happen without the agency having to go back and go through the formal rulemaking process. When Section 2832.18 was passed, the Legislative Assembly recognized that there are possible constitutional questions about whether this committee has the authority to void rules, and there is an alternate process that is set out in that section if that should happen, if that process would be declared unconstitutional. Other assignments of the
How are you? Doing all right.
We'll call the Administrative Rules Committee back to order, and we'll move on to the 10:15 agenda item, presentation from the Public Service Commission.
Chairman Devlin, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Patrick Fawn. I'm with the Public Service Commission. I'm the Director of the Public Utilities Division. And the Commission has asked me to testify today concerning rules recently promulgated by the Public Service Commission. Attached, I think did everybody get a copy of the answers to the committee questions? Attached to that as well is the summary, the notes that I'm going to be using for the summary this morning. And in general, in summary of the questions that the committee has, the rules did not result from statutory changes made by the Legislative Assembly. The rules were not mandated by any federal law. The Commission issued a formal notice of intent to amend administrative rules and issued a notice of public hearing and published an abbreviated notice in 52 official county newspapers. No regulatory analysis was required on any of the changes. The regulatory and small entity impact is neutral or positive on the rule changes. There's no fiscal effect on state revenues and expenditures or funds controlled by the Commission. The rules would not limit the use of private real property. The rules would not result in a taking or regulatory taking. And in one instance, the North Dakota Association of Telecommunications Cooperatives, Dave Carruthers, commented in support of the changes, and that were changes to 690204-01 and 02. Otherwise, there were no written or oral concerns, objections, or complaints for agency consideration. Okay, so on to the rule changes. The rule changes in 690204-01 is related to individual customer notice in utility rate-related cases. The existing bill stuffer rule, the utilities usually provide notice to the customers, is by bill stuffer. And the existing rule lists several cases in which the applicant utility must provide individual notice to customers, because those filings have rate-making consequences and impact the rates to the customers. The proposed change adds one additional type of filing called an advanced determination of prudence filing, to which the company must provide advance notice to the customers and provide rate-making impact. The second rule change is to 690204-02, and that is related to appearances at formal hearings. Currently, there's a requirement that staff who work on formal cases be noted on the order as making a formal appearance, and that is being deleted. At hearings, council introduces staff working on the case, but the rule requiring staff members be listed in the appearance could imply that staff analysts are practicing law. That's my understanding. The next change is to admin code 690207-02, related to the filing and the comment period timeframes for a rulemaking process. One of the changes to this section eliminates an outdated requirement to file proposed rules and rule notices with the Legislative Council at least 30 days before the hearing. The current law, which is North Dakota Century Code Section 2832.10, subparagraphs 1A, requires filing with the Legislative Council, but does not impose a time requirement on this filing. The other change reduces the post-hearing comment period from 30 days to 10 days, which then is also now consistent with North Dakota Century Code Section 28-32-12. The next change to admin code is for sections 690204-01 and 02. And that is related to procedures for protecting information filed by telecommunications companies. The current rule prescribes protection for certain information. That information is protected without the need for the originator to file an application for trade secret protection, without the need for staff analysis, and without further action by the Commission. And that includes detailed information concerning telecommunications infrastructure projects and detailed information regarding service outages, and that must be filed in an annual report to the Commission. And I'm referring, this protection The existing protection I'm referring to as like a prescribed protection for trade secret information. Now this, the rule change extends this prescribed protection to those two information types contained not just in the annual report to the commission, but to any filing with the commission. And it also expands the protection to specific data, like data of volumes of local services by service type, such as residential and business, and local exchange, like such as differences between Fargo, Castleton, or Hillsborough. And it also provides this prescribed protection for information regarding volumes of and revenue from switched access traffic by jurisdiction, such as intrastate versus interstate, and or by local exchange. And the third type of protection, a third type of information would be any financial information that is protected by the Federal Communications Commission protective order. The commission receives about 80 or more filings each year that contain some or all of these types of information, and the rule change will result in a more efficient administrative process and will save resources for both the regulated community and the agency. And as I noted earlier, the North Dakota Association of Telephone Cooperatives filed comments with us in support of the change. I'll stand for any questions from the committee.
Questions from the committee? Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple quick questions. On 6902-0402, which is on page 22 of our book, you said that noting the name and position of each member of the commission staff, the way it's currently required under rule, could imply that they're practicing law without a license. And I'm just curious about that, because all the rule says is anyone who's participating in the hearing or investigation, and you don't need to be a lawyer to participate in a hearing. So I don't think before the commission, do you?
I don't either, Mr. Chairman. However, our attorney feels that is potentially an issue.
Okay. Well, it's your prerogative to change it. It just struck me as a little strange. I was just curious. And secondly, on the next one, 6902-07, you mentioned that there's no requirement, time requirement for filing the notice with the Legislative Council, the notice of proposed rules and so on. But I think the assumption is that they should be filed in advance or early.
Yes.
Taking anything out implies you could file them 6 months later if you wanted to, which certainly isn't the intent.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that the rule, or the law, still requires that it be filed in advance.
Okay.
But it doesn't specify the amount
of time.
The statute
says that. Okay, thank you.
Yep. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I think our commissioner had a few comments on this rulemaking as well.
We will get to Commissioner Christman in a moment. Any further testimony for this presenter? Any questions? Thank you.
I appreciate it.
I saw Commissioner Christman. There we go.
Good morning, Chairman Devlin and committee members. For the record, Randy Christman, Chairman of the Public Service Commission. And I just wanted to add a couple of thoughts to what Mr. Fahn talked about regarding Section 6902-04-01 and 2 regarding the proprietary telecommunications information. Something I'm really proud of that we've been doing these last few years at the Commission is communicating with the regulated industries, whether it's the coal industry, the oil and gas industry, the wind industry, or in this case, the telecommunications industry, on things where we don't have a docket going, but just trying to keep dialogue going and finding out how our regulatory relationship is working out. This is something that cropped up from a conversation like that. Patrick mentioned we have about 80 of these filings a year from the various telecom companies, and some of this information, and these are generally FCC requirements. The FCC requires them to send them to us too. We don't do much with them, to be honest with you, except for spend enormous amounts of legal time analyzing which of these things should be proprietary if they ask. However, in one of the forms, it's proprietary by federal law. So in that discussion, we found out some of the telecoms seek the protected status of that same information on the other forms. Some of them assumed that it was protected because it's protected over here on this other form. So this is really, I think, a bigger deal to them than us, because some of them are putting that information out there and now it's not protected because they didn't realize they needed to ask for it. When they do the right thing and ask for it, it takes a whole bunch of our time. And when I say it's protected, I just want to emphasize it is available for someone to come in and view. They just would need to sign a confidentiality form because it's not available for a competitor to use against them. So that's what we're seeking to do here. To me, it's really a win-win situation for both our cost savings as well as the industry's protection. And I think a good example of government working pretty well. And I would stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner Christman. Is there any questions for the Commissioner? Senator Anderson.
Chairman Desmond, Commissioner Christman, can you explain for me the difference between confidentiality? Because if I can come in and review it and I'm a competitor, then how is it confidential?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I can't explain that as well as you'd like, but other than that is just the way the law works. These types of things are available for people to review, but they're not available on our website like most of our information is for you to just casually peruse. And it's long, detailed, documented stuff. You cannot just call one of our staff people and ask to send a copy. And so you can come in and review it, but you do sign a confidentiality statement. So if you're the competitor, and you take some of this information and it can be shown that you used it to compete, you might have some problems there.
Senator Armstrong.
Mr. Chair, do people actually come review it?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Armstrong, none of our staff could think of anyone ever reviewing any of this, but we do have other things that fall under the same status in other industries, and some of those that happens, yes.
Further questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
This is pretty boring stuff. Thanks, Committee.
I don't expect that there is, but was there anyone from the regulated community here on these rules that wanted to offer any testimony? Seeing none, thank you. I think we're going to go into the 1050 thing in a minute, but we had a couple of questions from new members on how they're notified by the rules, when they're notified, the ones that are going to be before us at the next meeting, so on and so forth. So I think I'll let Vinette give a little explanation of what you're going to get on email and when you're going to get it, and then if there's any further questions, feel free to ask.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple questions from Senator Russ during the break, and I thought this might be good information to pass on to everyone. You probably have noticed you're receiving emails periodically that contain notices and proposed rules. It's just usually a one-sentence email saying that these rules have been submitted to Legislative Council. This is the full notice. I don't know the exact wording. But what you're receiving in those notices is that full notice that I explained is required by the agencies. They are sending that full notice to us with their proposed rules. We place that on our website, and on your home page, I'm not sure if you have your computers with you, but under Information Center, there is a link that says Agency Rules Information. And when you click on that, a calendar will open, and it's a calendar by month, you know, just a regular calendar, and it shows each day of the month, and it'll list if there is a hearing on that date. And for example, on September calendar, on September 5th, Department of Human Services, the Attorney General's office had hearings that day on proposed rules. That's that first step in the process after the notice is sent out. 20 days after that notice, they can hold this hearing. Following that hearing, they keep the comment period open for 10 days. At that point, they can finalize those rules. They submit those to the Attorney General's office for an opinion as to making sure that they followed the procedure and that they haven't exceeded statutory authority. At that point, those rules get submitted to our office. It is at that point that we start putting together the supplement that you have before you. These are the final rules. The rules that you're getting in those emails are the proposed rules. The supplement is an email that will come to you about a week to 10 days before the meeting, and it will have all those rules that are going to be considered at the upcoming meeting. As I mentioned, we are sending these out by email. They are available in paper copy if that is your preference. Right now, most people do it by email, but we will have paper copies always available at the meeting. Or if you happen to be in town and you know, stop up and want to grab a copy. We don't print a lot of extra just because of costs of printing. We may have an extra set or two for each meeting, but generally we have printed, you know, enough for the committee members. Any questions on that? Does that make make sense to you? It's kind of a long, complicated process. The other question that Senator Russ had, he said, so if I'm getting these and they're on this calendar, are they going to be on the next meeting? Not necessarily. It's only if they've completed all those steps and got the Attorney General's approval before the next meeting. The meeting we're going to have in December, I believe it's December 5th, to get on that agenda, they will have to be through that entire process with the Attorney General's opinion by November 1st and have those submitted to our office. They will go on the December 5th agenda and then the rules will go into effect January 1. So that would be the next cycle.
Does that answer some questions, or is that, I mean, feel free to drop Vanette or myself a note or whatever, there's further questions. But I mean, the key thing is when you get the notice of our meeting and what rules we're going to be seeing that day, to make sure you go through them all. You know, I used to always do it by paper, but I found it just as easy to do it on a computer, because this is here. You have to move back and forth between the pages when you get to the meeting. The booklets are always here, but you know, you'll be able to get it and be able to review it, and if you have questions, make note of it. So okay, are we ready for the presentation?
I think so.
Okay. I'll let Vanette go into this deeper, but when the Federal Trade Commission ruled against the licensing board in North Carolina, it set up a lot of concerns across the nation, and NCSL and others have got very involved in helping states make sure that they meet the requirements for oversight on the licensing boards. And we were given the study to look at that, to make sure that we are doing it correctly and within the regulations that the Federal Trade Commission may want to look at. They monitor all the states. I know they're getting copies of whatever we do on it. I'm afraid that there's some people that believe that this committee will start looking at each licensing board individually and why somebody didn't get their license and what objection you might have. And that isn't the intent of the study. The study is outside that. We just want to make sure that the state of North Dakota is complying with the oversight required of licensing boards. If you're here and you have a particular problem with your board, there are other venues, including legislative possibility of bringing something before the legislature or working with an attorney or whatever, but this study is not going to allow you to express the problems that you've had with the whatever licensing board it is. That was not the intent of the study. It's just to make sure that we comply with federal regulations on the oversight. So, Vanette.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The background memo, the number at the top is 19.9110.01000. State Licensing Board Supervision, this is the background memorandum. This This study is the result of House Concurrent Resolution 3026, which was sponsored by the chairman. It provides for a study of the membership and state supervision of the state's occupational and professional licensing boards in order to retain federal antitrust law immunity. This request was in response to the 2015 United States Supreme Court decision known as North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners versus the Federal Trade Commission. In that case, the Supreme Court held that when a controlling number of a state's occupational or professional licensing board members are market participants, the board must be actively supervised to be immune from antitrust law. Some background on licensing boards. Licensing boards are a creation of state law. They are laws govern the professions and provide for regulation oversight of licensees through the appointment, often by the governor, of members of the professional licensing board. That board is responsible for ensuring that licensees maintain high standards of professionalism and quality of care to safeguard public health and safety. Boards adopt administrative rules, they discipline licensees, and they respond to consumer complaints. Most licensing boards have statutory authority to sanction licensees for unprofessional or unlawful conduct by way of reprimand or suspension or revocation of a license. When a majority of members of a licensing board are competitors of the individuals regulated by that board, board decisions and policies that restrain trade may raise antitrust issues. Licensing board members often are either unaware of the applicability of the antitrust laws to their board, or they're inadequately educated to recognize the types of actions that may expose them to antitrust issues. Even if board members believe that competition restraining policies are necessary to ensure high professional standards, quality services, and quality patient care, a court may find that the policies do not justify the restraint of trade. Antitrust laws exist to ensure that the marketplace remains competitive. In 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Law was passed by Congress, and it's a federal law that attempts to maintain a free and orderly marketplace by prohibiting monopolies and other restraints of trade. When businesses, which are commonly referred to by the courts as market participants, engage in prohibited anti-competitive behavior, those businesses expose themselves to liability under this federal antitrust law. The Sherman Act doesn't specifically distinguish state agencies from private parties when it comes to restraining trade, but since 1943, there have been a number of cases that include state action as immune from those federal antitrust laws. State action immunity is a doctrine that was created by the Supreme Court in 1943 in a case known as Parker v. Brown. That doctrine exempts from prosecution from antitrust laws a state if the state is certain activities the state has decided to regulate rather than allow the marketplace to discipline itself. The rationale behind that immunity is that when enacting the Sherman Act, the Congress did not intend to restrain state behavior. The state action doctrine provides immunity to states, meaning that if they're regulated and controlled by the state, they're not subject to those same antitrust provisions that would happen to someone who was a private actor. For that doctrine to apply, the Supreme Court has extended that state action doctrine to cover three sets of circumstances. The first, as I mentioned, is state conduct. Actions by state lawmakers or a state Supreme Court which result in anti-competitive efforts enjoy immunity from those federal antitrust acts. The second is closer to the situation we're talking here, is private parties acting under state supervision. There's a two-prong test that the Supreme Court developed in a case known as California Retail Liquors Association versus MidCal Aluminum, and this is often referred to as MidCal, in which private parties may claim state action immunity if the party's actions are pursuant to a clearly articulated and affirmatively expressed state policy, and that there is active supervision by the state. Those are the two requirements for private parties to enjoy that state action immunity. And then the third is municipalities, which is a little different issue than what we're talking about here. The case law in the area of antitrust laws with the state action immunity, which has been evolving since 1943, is what led to this question in the North Carolina Dental case. The question before the Supreme Court was, if a state agency in question is a professional licensing board comprised of private industry members, must another state actor supervise that agency in order for it to have that immunity from the antitrust laws? I'll go through a little of the background in the North Carolina case. North Carolina Dental Practices Act, which is the North Carolina law that grants the Board of Dental Examiners broad authority to regulate the practice of dentistry in North Carolina. It's a board of 8 members, including 6 who must be licensed actively practicing dentists, 1 member who must be an actively practicing dental hygienist, and the final member who is a non-dentist. The licensed dentists select the dental members, and the licensed hygienists select the hygienist member. The governor appoints the consumer member on the board. The board's primary function is to administer their licensing system in North Carolina for practicing dentists. If the board suspects an individual is engaging in unlicensed practice of dentistry, that board has the authority to bring an action to enjoin that or to stop that individual from engaging in that unlawful practice. In the 90s, dentists in North Carolina began teeth whitening services. Around 2003, non-dentists started entering that field, offering whitening services at a considerably lower price than the dentists were offering for the same service. The practicing dentists complained to the board about the non-dentists offering whitening services. The board did an investigation. At the conclusion of that investigation, the board issued 47 cease and desist orders on official board letterhead to the non-dentist whitening providers. They also, the letters requested the providers to cease and desist all activity relating to the practice of dentistry. The letters indicated teeth whitening services by non-dentists was a misdemeanor under North Carolina law. They also contacted the cosmetic art examiners and requested the board warn cosmetologists to refrain from teeth whitening services. The result of the board's efforts was to end the provision of teeth whitening services by non-dentists and to cause manufacturers and distributors of those products to either leave North Carolina or to decide not to do business in North Carolina. After a series of actions initiated by the Federal Trade Commission, this case eventually made it to the Fourth Circuit, Federal Court of Appeals, and it essentially upheld the FTC's conclusion that the board was a private actor because the board consisted primarily of market participants. The court said to invoke state action immunity as a private actor, the board could take anti-competitive actions to benefit its own membership. However, the board must first satisfy the clear articulation and those active supervision requirements in MidCal. The Fourth Circuit concluded that the board's anti-competitive actions did not have sufficient supervision to meet this active state supervision prong of that MidCal test. The Fourth Circuit determined that the board could not invoke state action immunity protection against the antitrust laws. This case was then appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the Supreme Court agreed to take up the case. On February 25th, 2015, the Supreme Court affirmed the Fourth Circuit's decision in a 6-3 decision. The Supreme Court rejected the board's argument and held that a board on which a controlling number of the decision makers are active market participants in the occupation that the board regulates must satisfy the MidCal active supervision requirement in order to invoke state action antitrust immunity. The majority also found that a controlling number of the board's decision makers are active market participants in the occupation the board regulates. And so the board is treated as a private actor and must show active supervision by the state. The court concluded that the board had not met the active supervision requirement. The court also affirmed the active supervision requirement is flexible and context dependent. The court did not address what procedures would be sufficient to show supervision. So there wasn't a lot of guidance on what states need to do there. However, the court did indicate there are four basic requirements of active supervision. The review must be substantive, not merely procedural. The supervisor must have the ability to veto or modify the particular decisions. The mere potential for review is not enough. It must actually occur. And the supervisor may not be an active market participant. The next section has been the state's response to this decision, and there are a number of appendices attached to your memo. The first is a report from National Conference of State Legislatures, NCSL. In response to that, they've indicated that there have been numerous lawsuits that have been filed against licensing boards. Most common complaints of the boards have been difficult entry requirements, arbitrary restrictions, and unclear definitions of the scope of the profession. Most of those claims have been settled or dismissed because those were not antitrust claims. To assist state legislatures, governors, and licensing boards, the Federal Trade Commission has issued a 13-page guidance paper, which is attached as Appendix C. That paper advises states to avoid antitrust laws by creating regulatory boards that are advisory only, or by staffing those boards with members who do not have a financial interest in the occupation being regulated. According to NCSL, the primary question states have been working to address is who should do the supervising. That report indicates that states are handling supervising through executive orders, legislative proposals, and opinions issued by the state's attorneys general. For example, in Connecticut, passed a law last year that makes the exercise of statutory functions, including licensing, subject to the approval of the state's Department of Consumer Protection. Indiana has formed a committee to review its appeal process away from the single administrative judge to a panel of judges. Governors in Alabama and Massachusetts have issued executive orders establishing regulatory oversight boards to review, modify, or veto actions of boards and commissions. And Arkansas passed a bill in 2015 requiring all boards and regulations to be approved by a subcommittee of the Legislative Council. Previously, that subcommittee only had a review authority. Also, to address those concerns, the State and Local Legal Center, Washington, D.C., has provided some information, which is Appendix D, that provides some options to states. Again, this is kind of a repeat of some of the NCSL things, but you know, do not put a number controlling number of active participants on the boards. Actively supervise the boards on which the controlling members are market participants, or to forego state action immunity by not actively supervising and keeping a controlling number of active market participants on the board. And finally, there is an attachment by NCSL summarizing some of the state activity that has gone on in other states. In North Dakota, our licensing boards are regulated by statute and by administrative rule. The primary method of licensing individuals is done by the state statutory licensing boards. However, there are some professions that are licensed by state agencies, not by boards. Most statutes are contained in Title 43. We refer to this as our occupations and professions title. And the majority of those professions and occupations and professions licensed in that title are either healthcare or counseling related. Other professions in that title include abstractors, accountants, architects, social workers, trade professions such as electricians and plumbers, and other certain service industry workers such as barbers and cosmetologists. Some professions are licensed outside of Title 43, such as teachers in Title 15 and attorneys in Title 27. The membership of those professional boards varies from board to board. The governor appoints most members of licensing boards in North Dakota. Requirements for board membership among the many occupations include criteria such as age, residency, education, licensure in that regulated profession, and membership in a particular professional organization. And then finally, just some suggestions on the way this committee may want to proceed with this study. Encourage to receive information from the Attorney General's office. I think that's a key component in this study, is to get the Attorney General's take on what that office believes is the status of North Dakota's supervision at this point. Possibly, get additional information from NCSL and CSG regarding this case and what other states have done, and possibly we could invite representatives from either of those organizations to come and speak before this committee to review the structure and authority of the state's occupational professional licensing boards, and then develop any recommendations and prepare any legislation that might be necessary to implement those recommendations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no more voice.
I think during the last session, or at the end of the last session, when this bill came up for the North Carolina, I think 16 states NCSL were dealing in some manner with this. I'm sure it's growing more than that, and it's certainly something this committee is going to have to do some in-depth work on. I think what Vinette pointed out, NCSL and CSG, the Attorney General, more information from Legislative Council staff. We may want to get somebody from the Federal Trade Commission in here. We'll see how that plays out. I mean, we're open to suggestions from the committee, but we need to review this to make sure that our licensing boards are in compliance with federal regulations. So, Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I commend the chairman for introducing the resolution. I think it is an important thing for us to study. My question is for Vinette, and you alluded to, both of you mentioned bringing the Attorney General in, which I think is wise to get some perspective, but the Attorney General has already opined on this question with respect to North Dakota's status, I believe. Do we have a copy of that? A memo, or I don't know if it was a formal opinion, but.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Papelman, I don't believe it was a formal opinion. It was an email.
Okay.
We don't have anything official.
Okay. And my understanding of what the Attorney General essentially said is that he believes this is summary of that, not a specific quote, but that he believes that North Dakota is in better shape than North Carolina because of the function of this committee, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Koppelman, I believe that was one of the criteria. Another was that there is the Attorney General's review. There may still be the question of that, if that is considered active supervision.
I'm not saying that solves it or that that's accurate, but I know that was his initial.
That's correct. And I can track down a copy of that and email it.
Senator Fuhlman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank Bonnet for Appendix B. That's like a Supreme Court decision for dummies. I really appreciated that very much because that really lays it out. And I think that we absolutely need to move on, because when we talk about how broadly it can be defined in terms of what an active market participant is and in terms of what a controlling majority is, I think that we definitely should proceed, and those suggestions are excellent. I think we could find ourselves in some trouble.
Yeah, I think most of us that have been involved in the administrative rules process for a long time agree with you completely. Committee, is there anything? Obviously, this is going to take some time. We're going to be dealing with this, over the next year. Just so we have to have something ready for the session, we'll have it ready. So. I mean, other than what has been mentioned today between the national organizations, NCSL, CSG, the Attorney General, more from legislative staff, maybe Federal Trade Commission, is there anything we're missing? Is there anybody or any entity that you want to hear from on this issue. We'll make sure that that happens. It may be over the course of three meetings or whatever, but however it fits in with the rest of the schedule, we will see that that's taking place. Representative Koppelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the Vice Chairman's point, I think, you know, Appendix D is from the State and Local Legal Center, as Bonnet mentioned, and Lisa Saronin, who prepared this, we hear from often at CSG and the Executive Committee. She is kind of the Supreme Court watcher that looks at a lot of this stuff. But I think the broader question is not just, for us, the public policy question should be not just how do we stay out of trouble or how do we make sure we're within the white lines of the Supreme Court decision, but also what's the best public policy? Because the issue is really the fox watching the hen house. You know, you have a bunch of, pick your discipline, plumbers, attorneys, doctors, electricians, whatever it might be, and they're sort of supervising their own. And now there's good reason for that, because I don't understand what a plumber ought to know or an electrician ought to know and so on. But I think what the court is saying is that, you know, we in state government, we are potentially monopolizing, allowing professions or trades to become monopolized if we allow too much of that incestuous supervision rather than enough, be it legislative or independent member participation. So I think it's a big public policy question, as well as a question of just drilling down on the Supreme Court's comments.
And committee, I will guarantee you that you will hear from citizens of North Dakota that feel that their rights have been abused by their particular licensing board. That isn't what this study is about. I mean, if they want to go, no, we are not. So I mean, that there's different, as I said earlier, there's different ways for them to approach that, but that won't be part of this study. We aren't going to hear from 300 people that have had a problem with some particular board, unless it's Board of Pharmacy or something, then I might want to hear from all of you. But just so you know, is there anyone up? Senator Anderson.
Chairman Devlin, I'd like to, a little background. You know, the regulatory boards in North Dakota, the structure that we have is one I like, obviously. You've probably heard that from me before. But certainly there's always the potential. Now, I just had two individuals here, the executive and one of the board members from the North Carolina Board of Pharmacy, who are looking at how we do telepharmacy in North Dakota, and I took them around the state. And just as a background, they and other boards in North Carolina told the dental board, please don't do what you're doing. They knew that they were stepping over, but the dental board wouldn't listen, you see. And so consequently, we have this whole big brouhaha where actually they were trying to enforce guidances that weren't in their laws, weren't in their rules, but that they were trying to enforce them on people. And we come up with guidances every once in a while too, but they don't have the force of law. And if you try to discipline somebody based on a guidance when it's nothing in the law or nothing in the rule, that's when you get in trouble. And that's really the background here of what the North Carolina Dental Board was doing. Contrary to the advice of the medical board and the pharmacy board and other boards in North Carolina who tried to tell them to cease and desist before you get us all in trouble, which is what they did eventually. So certainly a study is good, and we can look at all those things and make sure that we don't have similar instances in North Dakota where boards are overstepping and doing things that the rules or the laws that we have as legislators have had an opportunity to participate in are other things are trying to be enforced. So.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to that? Senator Anderson is correct. It's difficult to say North Carolina is doing this, so we must be not in compliance. You have to look at actually what, you know, it's sometimes it's apples and oranges. You know, you have to actually look at the statute. And I've read, it's like, you know, if North Carolina law had said teeth whitening services are dental services, there wouldn't have been a case because the statute would have given them that authority and no one else could have done that service. So it's difficult to compare, you know, you're right, you have to look what's in the statute, not just what the practice is. If, you know, in North Carolina, that board had the authority to issue those cease and desist orders. Not all boards in North Dakota have that authority. You have to look at, you know, what the statutes are, what the oversight is. Not every state has this setup of an administrative rules process. There are few, if any, states that have the ability to void a rule, which would be some type of an act of supervision. So it's one of those we're going to say, you know, let's do what Minnesota does. We can't do that because they have different laws than we do. So it's very unique to North Dakota.
And committee, this, you know, like I said, this is early in the process. I don't need all your suggestions and answers today, but as we proceed, I want the committee to be very involved in what we're doing and make, you know, if there's something out there you say you think we should look at this, make sure you get a hold of Vinette, because we'll look at whatever the committee wants to look at and whatever we feel we have to do to make sure that this study is done right. Representative Bean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have to go through all the boards and stuff to verify that they're okay, or how do we proceed with this? Do we have Vinette go through and say who's all appointed to the board? If there's, you know, like massage therapists, there's so many of those that are on, do we have to change some of the makeup of the boards, or what, I guess, is kind of our starting point?
I'm getting that look that maybe I should run this up the flagpole first, but just because there's market practitioners that are in a majority on the board doesn't mean that it's completely wrong. We have to make sure that we have the supervision at the Federal Trade Commission of that board, no matter how it's structured. That's really where we're at. If some legislator wants to introduce a bill to change some makeup on one of the regulatory boards, they certainly have every right to do that, but that's not, you know, that's not what we're doing here. So, you may.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Baining, some of the case law I've read too, they said, you know, just putting a majority of non-market participants on a board isn't enough. It may require, say, you have a 7-member board, four are non-market participants and three are, but perhaps, you know, the statute requires, five people have to vote on to approve something, which would require one of those market participants essentially then is controlling the decision. Even if that was, even a simple majority, there's cases where they said, even though it's a majority of non-market participants, they're relying on the opinion of the market participants because they don't know the industry. So they're essentially influenced by them anyway. And it becomes a market participant decision. So that isn't necessarily the solution.
Mr. Chairman.
You may proceed.
Wasn't the pick on massage therapist or anything, it was just, I didn't know where to start. And just kind of, so it's basically it's going to be more of the burden on us to prove to the FTC or to the courts that we're regulating properly and have the oversight versus the board themselves.
That there's active supervision.
Okay.
That's the key question, the active supervision, you know, so Representative Koppelman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just something that Vinette just said in response to Representative Baining's point, and I think that's a real viable reality to consider as we look at this is, you know, my experience both in serving on some of these things that we get appointed to as legislators sometimes and watching also how some of the boards work. What you just described is the norm. I mean, if you have lay members on a board that is supervising a profession, let's say, what are they going to do? You know, they listen to the opinion of the professionals in the room because they're not experts in that role, in that field, and so they are heavily influenced. I don't know how we, you know, I don't know if we can solve that, but I think it's a reality we need to be aware of. And it'll be interesting, you know, to hear how that, in the opinion of those who testify before us who are part of these various supervising boards, how that functions in their board. I'd be interested in hearing some of that information as we go forward.
Anything else from the committee at this point? See, it's very early in the process, but is there anyone here from any of the licensing boards or the general public that wants to say anything at this time? I mean, there will be several months for you to do this, but go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Steiger, and I do not have prepared testimony, so I'm going to try to keep my thoughts together as they're swirling around. I am the chairman of the board for the Steiger Consulting Group, and we're an association management and lobbying firm. And we represent and have represented for quite a number of years four either regulated professions, architects, engineers, psychologists, and funeral directors. And we also represent the State Board of Architecture and Landscape Architecture for 28 years. So I have some background in this. And when we started representing the architects, I learned that the, and three of those are professional societies, which are made up of the members are regulated professionals. One of them is a licensing board. And at the time that we started representing the architects, I became aware that the American Institute of Architects was under a federal judicial sanction from the Federal Trade Commission for this very thing, price fixing. And they had a 10-year window in which all of the members of the association across the country had to watch what they called the hard hat video, which was a tutorial to remind the members not to participate in activities that were illegal. And what they were doing was they were working with state agencies of government to set fees for architecture services and on a sliding scale. And so it was just a fee table that was used by everybody, which seemed like a logical thing to do to save the state of the state money. And I don't even remember what state it happened in, but the result is, and if you look at it now with the eyes that we have acquired and the knowledge that we've acquired since then, we can spot that as restraint of trade. But that's part of the increased awareness and education that we've all become much more sensitive to. And so over the years, I have caught activities or conversations not only among the regulated professions in a particular organization, but also among the executive directors around the country who might be wanting to share information about negotiating contracts with hotels and speaker agreements and all of that sort of thing. And I'm in there immediately saying, you can't do that. You can't do that. Stop. If you're going to do that, I'm removing myself from this discussion board. And so, you know, it's just that heightened awareness that comes with being in the trenches. And so you are all faced with a heightened awareness because of what happened in North Carolina. You have three people for sure that I know of, maybe four, counting the lawyers in the room, that are members or were members of a regulated profession at one point. And we're all much more aware of that sort of thing. And the North Carolina decision brought an even greater increase in awareness of this kind of activity that's problematic. The way I see it, that in itself is self-correcting to a certain degree, because everybody is continuing to be raise the bar of awareness of what those kinds of activities look like. But also, I think you can find some reassurance. You really already have direct supervision of the licensing boards, not as a legislative body, but the state does, through the special assistant attorney generals who darn well should be advising those boards and participating in their meetings and saying, you can't talk about that. You can't consider a rule like that, and just stop it right there before it gets out of hand. And that's just in the normal day-to-day activities of a licensing board. I think that another piece that I see as problematic in my 28 years in doing this work, is where a licensing board or a profession gets involved with a bill in the legislature that, you know, we all talk about being a turf war or a turf issue, but the question is it really restraint of trade? And that's where I think where the problem can arise, and many licensing boards do not participate in supporting or opposing a bill that might come across as that. But I see a huge gray area in that regard. So you might want to look at that. Another item that, another group that you should think about talking to or getting information from in your continuing study is FARB. It's the Federation of Associations of Regulatory Boards. And that's a national organization that all of the, for example, let me back up, family tree. The State Board of Architecture and Landscape Architecture is a member of and participates actively in the National Council of Regulatory of Architect Registration Boards. There are 54 jurisdictions that are members of that group. And there is an extremely heightened awareness just in those national meetings that we go to about this very issue. And so again, that gets back to my point about self-correcting, but the NCARB, National Council of Architect Registration Boards, is a member of FARB. And so you might want to consult with them also and see what they are doing. They are extremely active in educating licensing boards on this issue. Again, part of the self-correcting. But I tell you all of this and suggest to you that your immediate access to supervision is through the Special Assistant Attorney Generals. And I would be happy during any time during your interim work to assist or offer my assistance in any way that I can.
Thank you. Is there any questions for Bonnie when she's up here? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is there anyone else? Like I said, it's early in the process, and we will welcome input as we proceed. Seeing none, I think, Vanette, we'll just proceed with where we are now on the initial thing and set up some meetings and have the Attorney Generals in at one of the next, maybe the December meeting, to try to explain where they feel the state is at. And I want to get NCSL and CSG here because I know that they can bring a lot of expertise to the table that we need, you know. So we'll, you know, if somebody comes up with another idea from the committee, feel free to get hold of us, because we want to hear from you. We want to make sure this is done right. Committee discussion on anything else today? You have something you'd like to say? Oh, no, he's had his day.
He's halfway to the door.
Yeah. If not, we are adjourned.